Facebook on Tuesday said it's identified a coordinated campaign to influence the 2018 midterms, activity that's consistent with Russian efforts from 2016. The social network said it removed 32 politically oriented fake accounts and pages from the platform and Instagram due to what the company called inauthentic behavior, and were followed by almost 300,000 other Facebook accounts.
9 U.S. states are scrambling to stop the online publication of designs for 3D printable guns, which could become available later this week. The state's filing a lawsuit Monday against the Trump administration for allowing the Texas-based company Defense Distributed to legally publish gun blueprints on the internet. Until recently, the government had argued that the blueprints posed a national security risk. But in June, the State Department reached a settlement with Defense Distributed, which says it will start publishing gun blueprints on August 1st.
Chipotle, yet again, a bit tough to stomach for diners and investors. The stock plunging as much as 9% Tuesday after at least 140 people reported feeling sick at a location in Powell, Ohio, over the past few days. Consumers posting what most called food poisoning on the food safety site IWasPoisoned.com. It's unclear if these were official doctors' diagnoses. The posts are anonymous, and Reuters could not immediately verify the accounts.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's August 1st. Welcome to it. Another business day, another business month underway, 5:10 in the morning. And we are happy you have selected us this morning for your get up, wake up call. And lots to cover this morning on the program. We'll go through some of the market numbers momentarily. A little bit later, Ben Friend will be here from streetsblog.com talking about a new study about Uber and Lyft, how they're overwhelming urban streets and cities. And even impacting climate. We'll have that in our second segment at about 5:40. In a minute, we're going to be talking about something called the back-to-school shopping paradox. As back-to-school shopping gets underway in earnest, our first guest will be joining us here momentarily. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures in the United States are pointing toward a mixed open later on Wall Street. Dow futures are lower by about 39 points, and NASDAQ futures are higher by about 12. S&P futures are lower by about 3. Oil is trading at $68.02 a barrel, which is down about 73 cents. In Europe, markets are generally in the red, with the FTSE off almost a full percent in London. Markets off just a fraction in Germany and in France. And in Asia this morning, markets are generally mixed, with the Nikkei going to end the day up about 3/4, 192 points. But the Hang Seng is down almost a percent at 242 points. Again, futures pointing toward a mixed open on Wall Street in the U.S. later this morning. A couple of stories that we're watching for you before we get going this morning. Apple made more money from higher-priced iPhones in the latest quarter, even as unit sales were relatively unchanged. Shares of Apple rose 3% yesterday after it reported fiscal third-quarter results that beat Wall Street expectations. Unit volume rose just 1% from a year ago. New phones expected to come out in the next year or so. The iPhone X had good sales, according to the quarterly report. The base models, the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, also did well compared to their predecessors. You heard there in the opening montage, Facebook has elevated concerns about election interference heading to the midterms again. Company careful to hedge its announcement yesterday. Doesn't link the effort directly to Russia or the midterms, but it does say it follows the sort of same pattern as election interference in the 2016 election. And when the Federal Reserve wraps up its latest meeting today, it'll likely point to strong economic growth, low unemployment, and rising inflation as reasons to stay on a path of gradually raising interest rates. It is unlikely to raise interest rates today. Fed statement may also discuss potential risk from rising trade tensions, but it is almost certain the statement will not acknowledge the recent criticism lodged at the central bank by President Trump. Front and center this morning, the back-to-school shopping paradox. Leslie McNamara is with us this morning, the Managing Director of Market Development at Citi Retail Services. Leslie, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Yes, good morning, Steve, and thank you for having me on this morning.
Tell us about the back-to-school paradox, shopping paradox. What do we mean by this?
Well, so first, Steve, for about 3 years, City Retail Services has been running a survey taking a look at parents and children and how they spend money in the back-to-school time period. And while initially we really focused on the dichotomy of online and offline shopping as younger generations or millennials and Generation X came to the marketplace, this year we really focused in on the impact that children have when they go shopping with their parents and when they're present in the decision-making process, and also the impact that they had not just on the cost of it, but on the time and savings components of it. And we found some really interesting things. The first is that parents are more concerned about saving money than they are saving time. And they have a belief that including their children is actually an efficient way for them to manage the back-to-school spend experience. But the paradox really is that children increase the spend as well as increase the time, the commitment that they have in that process. So, for example, Steve, what we found is on average, and averages are always tricky, is people will spend about $322 on back-to-school spend. It's probably one of the biggest discretionary spends consumers will make other than the holiday season. But if they include their children in that equation and bring them to the store with them, it'll cost them about $100 more to do that.
Yeah, so that's a significant number. But time is money, right? And so I'm guessing that the parents are okay with not perhaps having to go back and return clothes that don't fit if their kids aren't with them, or they get the wrong computer or wrong tablet or wrong piece of equipment for the classroom.
Yeah, and that's really where I think parents are most concerned about having their children with them, is are they going to purchase the right thing? They don't want to go through the return process. But there's also a social component to it, that there's an opportunity to connect with their children in a different way and to share the experience together. So there's both social as well as economic decisions that go into that purchasing experience.
I didn't think about that, a chance to sort of spend time with your kids, talk about the upcoming school year, perhaps other social issues, like how they're doing just generally, right?
That's absolutely true. And it's the time to connect really around what fashions, what are they interested in, what are their friends purchasing. So more communication or information probably goes across that exchange than maybe kids even understand.
Leslie, is there a happy medium here? Is there a way that we can get that $97 savings and still make out here? Or is this just something that the data shows is impossible to do?
Well, parents did share some hacks with us in ways that they can keep that expense down if they provide structure or think ahead in the process. One of the things they shared with us is just reusing leftover items from the previous year. About 60% of people say we go through backpacks, we take a look at what they used the previous year, and use the handy list. You know, a lot of retailers will give you a list of what you need for back to school and compare those items against that list. The second thing they told us is scour your house, is look for pens, look for highlighters, look for the items, take the time before you go to the store and just sort of thoughtlessly purchase things because it happens to be on a list that's required for back to school. My favorite, though, about 30% of the people do this, and honestly, I never thought about it when my son was growing up, is they take the list or they talk to the teacher before their child goes back to school to say, are these items really necessary for your class? So they do due diligence at the school level before they go back as well. And those are ways to keep those costs down.
Oh, that's a good one, because you might the teacher might just been padding the list with stuff that, you know, wish list type stuff.
Yeah. Well, and also a lot of retailers these days are very clever and very helpful, honestly, in putting together a comprehensive checklist for back to school. This is particularly prevalent when you see it at the college age, what you'll need in order to go to college. And a lot of parents now print that data off, bring it to the store with them, and are methodically going through that list and purchasing everything. So using those check steps or those three hacks beforehand can really help keep the cost down.
Leslie, hang on with us. We're going to take a quick break here and continue our conversation with Leslie McNamara, Managing Director of Market Development at City Retail Services. We're talking about back-to-school shopping. Perhaps we can save you a few bucks.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back. We're on this morning with Leslie McNamara, Managing Director and Market Development at City Retail Services, talking about their annual back-to-school survey. Leslie, I know we were talking earlier about the tips of saving money. I'm curious how online shopping plays into all of these data points, this conversation.
Well, a couple things. We actually see, it really interesting, of all of the shopping seasons that consumers regularly engage in are identifiable, time-bound shopping experiences. Back to school is more in-store than it is online. 80% of parents tell us that they do most of their shopping in-store. So they may augment it with the online experience for items they weren't able to find. But by and large, this is pretty much an in-store experience. And we think that may have to do with, as we have been talking about, the ability to bring their children along and to have, a parent-child moment. But also because the average ticket price of the individual items is small, and paying the shipping for that small, basket or for that lower dollar amount can be really burdensome to parents who are really focused on saving money during this time period.
Yeah, I'm guessing, the online assistance, I'm thinking of Alexa as one of them, and people is any of that being utilized by parents at all?
We're not seeing that show up yet in our survey, but that may be a very good place for us to focus in next year's back-to-school survey. So thanks for that.
One of the other things I saw is that, in this in-store, parents are shopping in-store, they tend to find one store that they like the most. Is that what the data backs up?
Yeah, it does. Parents have found, and this is probably like one of the biggest tips, is what we saw in our research, is parents who shop at multiple stores end up actually spending more money. That they do better if they choose a favored retailer and they dedicate their money to that favored retailer and keep their costs down by binding the experience with their child and keeping sort of the limited merchandise. The other thing, though, that people told us was by going to a favored merchant, they could utilize discounts or savings or rewards programs that they may already have with that retailer and keep their costs down.
Do we expect any of the overall shopping numbers to be higher this year, considering the economy is doing better? I mean, in times when we see a better economy, does school shopping get a boost?
Yeah. So back to school is considered the bellwether of discretionary spending, particularly going into the holiday season. We're expecting that much as we've seen the economy expand and people have more confidence in spending, that we should see a commensurate growth in spending for back to school and hopefully also for the holiday season. So we'd anticipate that spend should be up about 3-4% year over year.
That's a pretty good a bump there. One other question, sometimes you see specials at stores where there's a package of goods, let's say a back to school kit, so that it has, five or six or seven things that are on the kids' list, all in one package for one price. Is that another way to save money for back to school?
Yeah, parents are divided on that. Some folks really love the value packages and see them as reducing the expense. This is probably the place, though, where having the child along can be a little bit disruptive, is if the package itself has items in it that the child isn't interested in or doesn't think, is, cool, or that their friends will have. They may see those as items they'll discard from the package. So the parent is sort of forced into a situation of going, do I really want to buy something where I'm only going to use, say, two-thirds of the package? Or am I better off disaggregating it and buying individual items that I know my kid's going to use?
I know it's probably this sort of anecdotal, but every time I think of back-to-school shopping, I always flash back to my childhood, and the hot item was the Trapper Keeper back when I was going to school. Everybody wanted the Trapper Keeper to put all their stuff in. Do you guys ever look at what the hot items are, is there too many of those to keep track of?
Probably the big hot items, are consistent from year to year, is new backpacks. That is probably the place where kids can make their, fashion statement or demonstrate their individuality. Covers for books, pens, the designs, those kinds of things tend to be the hot items in store.
Leslie, are there any other highlights or any other surprises from the survey that you want to share with us?
You know, I think that the biggest surprise for all of us really is just how many people purchase in-store versus online. There's a common belief out there that all of shopping is going into an online space and the physical retailers, you know, will struggle. But back to school, more than anything, highlights for us the importance of the store and the importance of being able to see and touch goods, and also to have a social moment, an opportunity to connect with other people. And it just remains surprising, you know, in a connected world where everything is available, you know, online, that we still value that social experience.
Well, Leslie, we appreciate you being with us this morning and sharing some of these data points and some of this information.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Leslie McNamara, Chief Business Development Officer at City Retail Services.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Chicago smart oven startup Tovala opened its first brick-and-mortar space last weekend in Lincoln Park, which lets people sample Tovala-branded meals and other recipes for free. Shoppers can try out the Tovala oven for themselves and leave the store with a device if they're ready to buy. Chicago software company 8th Light has acquired Adorable, a Madison-based tech startup that makes custom software and web platforms. As part of the acquisition, Adorable's 11 developers and designers are joining 8th Light, but keeping their offices in Madison. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Wednesday edition of The Opening Bell. There's a new report out about how much Uber and Lyft are contributing to the amount of traffic on our roads, especially in major cities like Chicago. We found an article on this at streetsblog.com focusing on New York City. But generally, Uber and trends here. Ben Fried is the editor at streetsblog.com, the editor-in-chief, and he's with us this morning. Ben, good morning. Thanks for getting up with us and being on with The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
When I saw this story, my eyes literally bulged out of my head because I think a lot of people, I think that perhaps Uber and Lyft are helping get cars off the road and get people, you know, perhaps not having owning their own cars. But some of the statistics here are pretty big. I guess give us the headline from this report and your reporting on this.
Yeah, like you said, the image that Uber and Lyft like to project is that they're a substitute for personal cars, and they're taking cars off the road. But what this study shows is that in big cities like Chicago and New York, they're mostly substituting for transit, not personal driving. And there's just no evidence that they are making car ownership any less prevalent in these cities. So what they're really doing is adding more traffic to the transportation systems of some of the biggest and most congested downtowns in the nation.
And the number of cars and the mileage here is what the reports are focused on. I mean, we're talking about, in some cases, a doubling or tripling of the number of cars, right? And then the other part of this is adding, you know, millions of miles.
Right. It is adding you know, in the millions of miles a day, billions a year annually. I wouldn't say it's doubling total traffic in city streets. What it is if you have a given set of trips that you are making with your own personal car, the trips that people are making with Uber and Lyft are equivalent to about 1.8 times that mileage. So it's like, if Uber and Lyft didn't exist, we would have about half the traffic that Uber and Lyft are generating themselves.
Yeah. So another way to put that is that your car would generally be in the garage during those times, and in this case, it would be out all of the time, in other words.
Yeah, the thing about Uber and Lyft is, in addition to mostly substituting for transit and not personal cars, there's this whole phase of the trip where no passenger is in the Uber car. You know, the driver has to go and pick up fares, and for every 5 miles that they drive with a passenger, they're going 3 miles just waiting for a fare and then going to pick up that fare on average.
Is the Uber pool, are the pool services here helping at all reduce the numbers of trips?
You know, a pool trip is better than an unpool trip, but only a small share of the trips are pooled, about 20% now. And one of Schaller's interesting findings is that even if they meet their targets, which are like getting to 50% share trips within a few years, it's still going to be a net addition to traffic, you know, compared to a scenario where we just didn't have Uber and Lyft.
You know, part of the, we've been talking about cars here, but transit's another big part of this. I know New York, there have been lots of stories lately, too, in Chicago as well. The number of people using public transportation is down. People think they can get to work faster and in some cases cheaper by taking an Uber or Lyft into work. What are the long-term impacts on transit, public transit, from this study?
Yeah, well, long-term, Schaller says we need to basically take action now to avoid these effects from snowballing. You don't want to have a long-term abandonment of transit, because that just makes the whole system work worse for everyone. And, you know, his prescription isn't necessarily to, you know, crack down on Uber and Lyft. It's to make your transit better. So, you know, more bus lanes on the street, run more frequent bus service, really invest in your transit network so that people see it as a attractive alternative. And, you know, they want to take the transit service because it's so good. And, you know, Schaller says that's the way forward as opposed to, you know, specifically cracking down on Uber and Lyft. He's very careful to say that they do have a role in the transportation system, you know, like taxis before them. But we really need to be mindful about, you know, providing good transit service that people want to take.
Are there other things, too, besides, you know, improving public transportation? Are we talking about perhaps doing congestion pricing? Is there some restrictions on perhaps allowing some of these cars, Uber and Lyft cars, into, you know, the congested downtown areas, certain city center areas? What are the other solutions?
Yeah, congestion pricing makes a lot of sense for a city like Chicago, for a city like New York, where these cars really tend to accumulate in the downtown. And it's really, it's more of a downtown problem than a problem throughout the city. There's a mismatch because where Uber and Lyft can really do the most good is in the farther out neighborhoods where transit is sparser. And, you know, these services can be helpful supplements to the transit system. But where people, where the Uber and Lyft drivers end up circulating and cruising for fares is in the crowded downtown. And that's where you really don't want more car traffic. So if you can use congestion pricing to sort of thin out traffic in general, and especially Uber and Lyft, and sort of push them out to the areas where they'd be needed most, that would be ideal.
Yeah, and it's not just the, you know, the city center areas that's seeing this. I mean, part of this report is that, you know, for smaller cities, Uber and Lyft might be a good thing. The problem we're talking about here is focused on the nine major metropolitan areas where most of these rides are happening. So this is a big city problem with these companies, right?
Yeah, exactly. In smaller cities, Uber and Lyft are basically fulfilling this need for a supplement to the transit system. But really, you know, most of the usage of Uber and Lyft are in these nine cities. 70% of all Uber and Lyft trips are in those big cities like New York, Chicago, L.A., Philly.
What has Uber, what have they said about this study, if anything? Have they responded at all?
They contest some of Schaller's findings. I think what they really want to avoid is some sort of cap on, you know, how big they can get. And, you know, that's the point of contention. And people who recognize that, who recognize Uber traffic as a problem, they don't necessarily agree on whether there should be this command and control response of capping or whether you should do everything with a price and just make it more expensive for them to cruise on the most congested streets in the city. But I think from Uber's perspective, they, at least in New York, have been pretty amenable to a congestion fee as long as it affects, you know, all traffic and not just Uber traffic. And what they have wanted to avoid is a limit on how many drivers they can have.
I guess it's smart to be part of the conversation now as opposed to reacting to some harsher reaction from these cities later on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of common ground between Uber and, you know, the transit advocates and analysts who want congestion pricing. And that could be a coalition that works together and tries to make this pretty politically difficult policy solution happen in big American cities in a way that it has not happened yet.
So if I'm an Uber or Lyft customer and I'm getting into that car this morning and I'm concerned about the climate change, that I have to take another second look at what I'm doing, don't I?
I would definitely, yeah, if you're concerned about the climate, you know, the bus and the train is still the way to go, or a bike if you can do that. And, you know, failing that, a share trip is always better than a solo trip.
Yeah.
And, I would say don't forget transit. Don't sleep on transit. Pay attention and advocate for better transit because that's how we're going to get the cities that we want and the climate that we want in the future.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question is, you know, what else can we do as customers, as commuters to have our voices heard and perhaps be part of this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, Uber and Lyft both, they've kind of been weaponizing their apps. They're, at least in New York, where there is some momentum to limit their services, they've been giving customers these alerts via the apps to kind of contact their council members. And I would just urge people to, you know, be informed and don't necessarily take the company's word for what the debate is and really... you know, do your best to study up on the issue before advocating against a policy that really is intended to make the whole city's transportation system better.
Ben, we appreciate you being with us this morning. Great report at, again, streetsblog.org. We're going to link out to this. It's on the NYC blog. We'll link out to the story. And we appreciate you getting up and being with us this morning here on the Opening Bell.
Great. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Ben Fried is the editor-in-chief of streetsblog.com.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a mixed open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are down about 35 points. NASDAQ futures are higher by about 16. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A good day in the soybean market yesterday as futures went up 3%. On hopes the United States and China would restart stalled talks to avert the trade war that has already slowed soy exports. But at the end of the day yesterday, the August soybean contract up 27¾ cents, putting it back above $9. The September corn contract gained a nickel, and September wheat gained 8 cents. Turning to livestock, lean hog futures fell sharply yesterday, weighed down by ample supplies and tumbling prices for pork bellies that eventually become bacon. And looking at the closing prices in that lean hog contract yesterday, the October contract down 52 cents at $50.72. August live cattle dropped 55 cents a hundredweight, and the August feeder cattle contract dropped $2.40 a hundredweight. But despite the tariffs and the trade situation, ADM reported yesterday in its earnings report that its earnings doubled, and it was actually helped by the U.S.-China trade row. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Wednesday, August the 1st. We'll get the ADP employment report due today. Also, the Mortgage Bankers Association reports on mortgage applications. Look at the consensus motor vehicle sales as well. The Treasury refunding announcement coming today. The PMI Manufacturing Index, the ISM Manufacturing Index, report on construction spending, and the EIA Petroleum Status Report. Also, the Federal Open Market Committee meeting announcement as the two-day meeting wraps up today, 1 o'clock Chicago time. Also today, earnings, a couple of companies reporting earnings, including Humana, Sprint, and Tesla. Just some of the things that could move the markets on Wednesday, August the 1st.